There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 special.
Broadcasting live from the 2018 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. For the love of words.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It's an absolute honour to be sitting on the same sofa as Dame Jenny Murray, whose voice is loved and known by millions of people, but to actually be in her presence. Welcome to Talking of Books, Jenny.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I had the pleasure of being at your International Women's Day panel, which you moderated so beautifully. It was a challenge, wasn't it?
It was very complicated because you had, or I had, a Pakistani-British woman, an American woman, a Saudi Arabian professor, and an Emirati doctor. Such different experiences across those four women, but really interesting things that they all had to say. It was one of my more challenging encounters, shall we say.
But it was amazing, and what I think particularly Dr. Hatoon said, or Professor Hatoon said, about how the laws for women must be codified, they must be put into written laws, so that even if they are not completely adhered to, at least the law is there and they can keep pushing. But without a law in place, it makes life very difficult.
That's right, and obviously the most difficult thing for Saudi women is, yes, you know, things are changing, yes, they are going to be able to drive, but still there's the guardianship where, you know, you cannot go out without a man to keep an eye on you.
Yes, yes.
And that has to change and has to be written into law so that there is some way of challenging what is assumed to be the correct way of doing things.
So what I felt as a member of the audience was the completely different challenges for women around the world, from Carmilla Shamsi, the wonderful author, Pakistani British author, who was long listed for last year's Booker with Home Fire, and then we had Cheryl Strayed, the author of her memoir Wild. You know, each one were talking about different challenges for women in the world, but I really did feel there was an incredibly positive feeling about that we need to keep going, we need to make sure that we don't step back. And it was interesting what I thought, particularly, again, Carmilla said about don't be, you know, this. They talked about feminine Nazi, which I'd never heard this term.
Yeah, someone from the audience said, you know, how do you deal with the term feminazi, which is an outrageously ridiculous, insulting term. And, you know, her view of it and my view of it is just tell them where to get off.
It's
outrageous.
Yes.
Because what's interesting about what's happening at the moment, I mean, I said at one point in the evening, somebody said, was this a similar moment that could be compared to the real start of the women's liberation movement in the late 60s and the early 70s, when I was, of course, 18, 19, 20, 21 during that period, very excited by it, getting the politics of it for the first time. And then we went through that whole period of, oh, you know, I don't call myself a feminist, but. And you'd say to them, what comes after the but? You know, does the but mean my husband's never changed a nappy? My husband's never done any shopping? My husband doesn't know how to cook? And they'd say, well, yes. And I would say, well, in that case, you are a feminist, because, you know, these are the kind of issues within the family that we're trying to resolve. And then people used to say, oh, you know, don't mention the F word, which was not the really rude F word, but feminism. And suddenly now, young women are proud to call themselves feminists. The Me Too campaign, everybody's saying, hang on, you know, we're not having this sexual harassment anymore. And the young people are coming with us oldies who've been at it for a long time. And what's most interesting for me, I have sons of 30 and 35, and their generation and the generation coming up behind them of men are with us. They get it. I mean, I know a lot of them have been raised by feminists, so they'd be too scared not to be feminists, but, you know, we can't do it without young men coming up behind us and saying, yeah, I get it.
And this was the important point raised by a young Emirati at the question. She was saying, you know, the government support us, the law supports us, you know, what is written in the constitution supports us, but if our family, if our fathers and our brothers and our mothers are not raising us and our male counterparts to understand that we are equal and we deserve the same treatment, then we will always be slightly disadvantaged. And I thought that was a hugely important part. And I know that I have to thank my parents for having, there was never a moment in my life where I didn't feel capable of something. Because I was a woman, it didn't ever enter my head that it would be any different than it was for my brother. You are going to be speaking about a history in 21 women at 2 o'clock today. So anyone listening and wanting to see and meet the legendary Jenny Murray, come down to the Intercontinental for her session. I believe there are still a few seats, but if you don't get down soon and get your tickets, don't blame us. I'm going to wonderful co-host today, James Mullin and Etchney Trainer. You're going to be talking to Jenny about all of the things that Jenny does and that she's been doing at the festival. And I know, Etna, you wanted to ask Jenny where she's been this morning.
Yes, indeed. I knew she was up rather early, a little earlier than I was, in a way. I was sort of jealous now that I didn't just get up early and go with you. Tell us about your very special trip this morning.
I got up at 5:30. I left here at 6:30 to go and see the racehorses, and we saw the more experienced horses out having their early morning gallop, not the ones who are racing tonight. Obviously they wouldn't be galloped in the morning because they'd be far too tired to do a race tonight. Unfortunately I won't be able to make the races tonight because there's a farewell do here. I would love to be at the races tonight. We saw them, we saw the jockeys, we met the trainers. And then we went to see the young colts, who are the yearlings and coming up to 2 years old. And, you know, those horses were... I'm mad about horses, by the way.
This was pretty special, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have been mad about horses since I was a tot. And they were the best mannered horses I have ever come across.
They told them you were coming. They had a little preview.
I think it's because, you know, they each have an individual groom, and they were very gently treated. You know, some of them, the ones that have a little bit of a chest problem, there were two of them, and were actually wearing nebulizers so that they were breathing in special stuff, like an asthmatic would, you know. And I thought, oh my goodness, these are the best cared for horses I've ever seen. But we went up to them, they popped their heads out of their stables, they kissed us, we kissed them. I know, this is mad, isn't it?
But what a lovely way to start your day.
Kissing horses.
Yes. And it just gives you that great air of joy and happiness to start.
So beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
How's the rest of your time in Dubai been, I mean, here at the festival?
Well, I only arrived on Wednesday morning. I made the mistake of taking the night flight from Heathrow. I thought, well, that's a good idea. You know, leave London at 8 o'clock and I'll be there at 7 o'clock in the morning. Forgetting the fact that actually for me it would be 3 o'clock in the morning. So Wednesday was a little bit of a write-off, really, because I was pretty tired. And then yesterday, Yesterday was Friday.
James. Today's Saturday.
Well,
we're right. We're back on track.
On International Women's Day, that was a really, really good day, because we had this rather strange appearance on CNN where we had a very short amount of time to talk about some very important issues. But then the panel here that we had talking about, you know, where we need to go next, how we press for change, whether we're a Saudi Arabian professor of women's studies and an Emirati doctor, a Pakistani, British author, and an American woman who knows Hillary Clinton rather well, of which I was really rather jealous. But we had a really, really interesting discussion.
Well, the combination of all that was great. James is going to get down to business here and talk to us about the book.
Yes, Isabel mentioned you've got this panel, or you've got this, you're speaking this afternoon about the book. So it's a history of Britain through 21 women. Can you talk us through that a little bit? I mean, why the number 21?
Oh, publishers, you know. I said, you know, I want to do a history of Britain through the women that people may not know very much about. And he said, okay, do 18. And I said, no, I can't possibly do it in 18. He said, all right, I'll give you 21. Now, trying to narrow it down to 21, I've been in very bad odour with people in Yorkshire, which is where I come from, when I've gone to literary festivals in Yorkshire, because my novelist is Jane Austen. And I adore Jane Austen. You know, Jane Austen is totally British because she observes very closely what's going on around her in the villages, lots and lots of different characters. And she's also really rather bitchy, which I really love about her. And she writes so elegantly and beautifully. But when I go to Yorkshire, they say, why is there not a Bronte in this book? I say, I'm terribly sorry, you know, yes, I really like Jane Eyre and I really love Wuthering Heights, but, you know, I couldn't fit them all in. So that was the real problem, was trying to choose who was going. The real difficulty was trying to choose. Margaret Thatcher clearly is in there.
She reluctantly?
Well, no, you know, as a feminist, it was a really difficult period where, oh my goodness, a woman prime minister, how fantastic. And then you discovered that woman prime minister was not interested in women's issues at all. But obviously she had to be in the book.
Jenny, we were talking about the importance of women who were associated with science. This was very important to have some of these lesser-known characters. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
It's terribly important because even now it's really difficult to persuade young women that science and technology are jobs for them because, you know, mostly at school it's the boys who do it. At university it's the boys who do it. In employment it's mostly young men. And I'm just going to hold my microphone a little bit closer because somebody told me to. And then you'll be able to hear me properly. But, you know, Mary Somerville, who obviously Somerville College is named after her, very, very important scientist. Ada Lovelace, I think, is one of my favourites, actually. Her father was Lord Byron, mad, bad and dangerous to know poet of very bad reputation. But her mother was a mathematician. So Ada actually benefited from having both those genetic inheritances, I suppose. She was a little bit mad, bad and dangerous to know. She had lots of boyfriends and behaved very badly. But she was also in on the earliest computers. And what's important about her is that she recognized for the first time that computing would not just be about numbers. It could be about art. It could be about flowers. It could be about literature. And she really made us realize how far we could take computers, when now, of course, we take that absolutely for granted. So she was really the first one. And then the other one is Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who was the first woman to qualify as a woman as a doctor. Now, the as a woman is important because there was another woman called James Miranda Barry who pretended to be a boy to get into medical school. Into medical school, worked as an army doctor for her, I never know quite which pronoun to use, throughout her career in the army. And it was only when she died that it was discovered that she was a woman and had at some point had a child. How she got away with that, I will never know. But Elizabeth Garrett Anderson is the one we really recognise as the first woman to qualify and start clinics and start really caring properly for women.
What fascinating revelations that you've come up with there. But do you think at this time, too, any of these women got the recognition they deserved at the time, or even now?
I think some of them did. I mean, most of them are women who came up, I tried to choose women who came up entirely of their own accord. The only one who got there because of inheritance was Queen Elizabeth I, with whom I became completely obsessed as a teenager. And when people say to me, Jenny, who would you like, who would be your ideal guest at a dinner party? She is always my number one, because there are a number of questions I would like to ask her. Primarily, you know, you were very lucky. Your father made sure you were educated. And fathers throughout this book who recognized that their daughters deserve to be educated and deserve to have their ambitions supported is really important throughout the book. But then to Queen Elizabeth I, yeah, he educated you, but how did you cope with the fact that he beheaded your mother? You know, that's a really...
a very difficult conversation.
Yeah, really tough thing to accept. You know, on the flimsiest evidence of infidelity, her poor mum, Anne Boleyn, was beheaded. A very horrible thing to do. But it also kind of explains why she was so determined once she became queen that she would never marry. She knew how dangerous her husband could be, frankly, and also that her husband would take her power away, and she was not going to have that. So I would also like to ask her, Elizabeth, virgin, really? Because I kind of quite like to think that she had a little bit of fun with Leicester or Essex, you know, although she used the virginity very, very powerfully in the way that she dressed and the way that she behaved. And the way she ran the country, spectacularly well for a very long time. So she did get the recognition she deserved.
And you're here with two Irish people. So Countess Markovitch, one of the great heroes of Irish history as well.
So we were just thinking that you've already begun the book on the maybe 21 women, you've one of them done, that changed the course of Irish history as well.
I had to have her in there because people always assume, you know, we've been celebrating this year the 100th anniversary of the Representation of the People Act in 1918, when women finally, and I never say were given the vote, they were not given it, they won it, you know, they worked really hard for it. And people always assume that the first woman to enter Parliament as an MP or to be elected as an MP was Nancy Astor, who of course was American, who said wonderfully, oh, why did I marry my husband? Because he was rich, of course. So she was a pretty smart woman. But she was not the first woman to be elected to the British Parliament. The first woman to be elected to the British Parliament was Constance, I pronounce it Markievicz, I suspect correctly, because I've been practicing.
We have the Irish pronunciation, and it kind of goes to Markovitch.
But, you know, she was Anglo-Irish. You know, her family were English aristocracy. She and her sister were apparently the most beautiful women in Dublin. But she apparently went off to a cottage somewhere in the Irish countryside and found a whole lot of paperwork about the Irish peasantry and discovered as a result of that how appallingly the Irish peasantry had been treated by the British aristocracy, and determined to do something about it, and became a member of Sinn Féin. And because she was elected to the British Parliament as a member of Sinn Féin, refused to take up her seat. She took an active part in the Easter Rising. It is alleged she shot a policeman. I suspect she probably did. And then she suffered very badly at the hands of the British authorities. She was imprisoned, treated appallingly, heard her colleagues being shot outside, and actually at one point said, I wish they had the courage to shoot me. But I guess because she's a woman, they didn't.
So maybe at the time, yeah, for her in that sense, being a woman was to her advantage. At least she, you know...
But she had a miserable time.
She did have a miserable time. But I think also, apart from being, you know, a woman who changed the British history, she's such a hero too, I think, you know, for the Irish women particularly too. And again, but I think you look back on a lot of these women, and do you think that women nowadays understand the work that the suffragette movement did, the work that all of these trailblazing women did to really get us where we are?
I think as a result of this year, they're beginning to, because there's been a lot of discussion about it. My publisher very sweetly took out the six women in this book who had most influence over the suffragette and the suffragist movements, and made a little book, Votes for Women, out of it, so that you get, well, first of all, Mary Wollstonecraft, who really wrote the first feminist book in the late 18th century, saying, look, you know, we should have the vote, we should have rights, we shouldn't just depend on getting married and depending on a man. So she really began it all. And then Emmeline Pankhurst, of course, and Millicent Garrett Fawcett. Millicent Garrett Fawcett ran the suffragist side of things, who believed in lobbying, arguing, talking to powerful men in Parliament to try and persuade them to change the law. And then Emmeline Pankhurst, who actually described herself as a bit of a hooligan, who said,
it's a lovely term,
you know, the suffragette movement, we have to be more radical. We have to get out there. Deeds, not words. And so she encouraged, you know, breaking windows, throwing stones through windows, damaging post boxes, always determined, even though I have at times called them terrorists, they determined that they would never harm anybody. They would damage property, but they wouldn't harm any people. But, you know, when you look at the way it all finally came to an end, I think you can't say one or the other won it for us. It was their joint efforts of lobbying and shouting about it. And then, of course, the war, when they gave up their activities on both sides because they wanted to contribute to the war effort. And women made such an important contribution to the war effort in 1918, they had to say, yeah, okay, women can vote.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we had.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.